I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one is with the Bosnian-American writer Alexander Hemon, a favorite in the New Yorker magazine for his very typically bifocal new century identity. Hemon is about equally rooted in Sarajevo and Chicago by now, about equally drawn, for example, to gaudy gangster histories in either place. He writes a very stylish immigrant English for one audience, but the interesting thing in the internet age is that Alexander Hemon also writes a political column online in Bosnian, not just for Sarajevo, but for Bosnians in the U.S. who wouldn't, maybe couldn't, read him in English. He's not writing about exile, Hemon says, because he can and does go back to Bosnia. Rather, he's writing the stories and the moral discoveries that come with displacement. Alexander Hemon, should we start with a joke? And I say it just because in all the fiction I've read of yours, there's somebody always ready to say, can I tell you a joke? And it comes out very, very funny and very, very dark.
Mujo goes to America and Suljo stays in Sarajevo. And after a while, Mujo starts inviting Suljo to come over to America. And Suljo says, no, you know, I like my kafana, I like my friends, I like drinking coffee in the morning, read newspapers. No, thank you. But Mujo is insistent and invites him again and again. And he says, you know, you don't have to do anything here. You just come here and the streets are paved with gold. There's money everywhere. All you have to do is bend over and pick it up. And Sulja finally comes over and Mujo takes him home. And Sulja says, all right, let me take a walk, see a little bit of your America. So he goes out, comes back. Mujo asks, so how was it? What did you think? And Sulja says, you were right. I was walking down the street and there was a bag full of money, at least $1 million. And Mujo says, $1 million? A bag full of money, $1 million? Did you pick it up? And Sulja said, do you want me to work on my first day here?
Did you describe yourself as a man without two countries, or was that somebody else's line?
That's not my line.
In the Lazarus Project, Brick says, I'm a reasonably loyal citizen of a couple of countries.
Right, yeah. I am too. I believe in citizenship, yes. And participate in both political and public spaces in various ways. That's very important to me. And they're not mutually exclusive. That's the interesting and maybe beautiful thing about the world today. They're not mutually exclusive. I can operate, as it were, in Bosnia, and I can operate in the United States.
Take apart that word, operate.
Well, I write a column for a magazine, Sarajevo Dani, which is engaged with many things, including American politics, for instance, and also Bosnian politics. I go to Sarajevo 2 or 3 times a year. And so I also write not only fiction, but this is by invitation, but I have written things for various American publications, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And I consider myself, as I said, a citizen of two countries. My Bosnian columns also are read by Bosnians everywhere, not just in Bosnia, because there's a vast diaspora, Bosnian diaspora, and many of them live in the United States. At every reading I give, they're Bosnians. So in a very strange way, I write columns in Bosnia and Chicago, which then I email to Sarajevo, which then are read by Bosnians in Chicago. And they're very often, particularly during the Bush years, they were about, you know, American politics and all this. In other words, our Americanness and Bosnianness, you know, went through Sarajevo for the Bosnians of Chicago in various ways. And that this is possible in the world today. You know, had I written only in English about those columns, had I written them only in English, they would not have reached Bosnians of Chicago, or they were less likely to reach Bosnians in Chicago. So in other words, in some ways, to create a kind of small Bosnian public space engaged with American politics. I wasn't the only one doing that, or I wasn't the only one who could engage them, obviously. But, you know, in my little domain, we have to go through Sarajevo, and that's a very interesting situation.
Well, it's a very classic cycle in all of your work, it seems to me. You write about Chicago in the first decade of the 20th century, Sarajevo in the last, and people keep turning up from one story to the next. The police inspector in Chicago becomes a philanthropist in the latter stories. What is this Chicago-Sarajevo connection?
Well, the connection is in me. I'm a loyalist by temperament, so Sarajevo means a lot to me. I know the city, and obviously what happened in Sarajevo to Sarajevo is in Bosnia is a central fact of my life. At the same time, Chicago is my adopted hometown, so to speak. And so when I think about cities and many things, they are going through Chicago and Sarajevo. But there's also something about the situation. This is BRICS situation, and it was my situation to some extent, the situation of many Bosnians and maybe many refugees. The situation in which trauma splits the life of the refugee to the before and the after, and the traumatic effect, whatever it is, the displacement, is the dividing point, so to speak. And to establish, to go beyond that trauma, to establish some sort of continuity in life, is necessary in more ways than one. But it's also a narrative challenge, so to speak, how to put the two halves together. You know, what was rent asunder has to be put together in some ways. And that's a formal challenge. It's also an emotional challenge, and it's a geographical challenge in some ways.
There's a gangster connection. I mean, we think of Chicago, the whole world thinks of Chicago as Capone City, and yet you deal also with these Balkan thugs who have their own kind of Chicago style. They pull it off with maybe more childishness, innocence, flair, or no, not more flair, certainly, but something. What's the connection, and what are the differences?
Well, the connection is that, the war brings out the worst in people, but also it gives a kind of structure to them. And war, not only is, this great historical event where people kill each other, but it's also the absence of law or the transformation of law, because there's some sort of law in the war, allows the worst among us to come to the fore. And though Chicago in the Al Capone days was different in many ways, what was absent was the presence of an abiding social project or connecting social project for many people. And that's something that is frightening to behold in many ways. Sarajevo was not a violent city when I was growing up there. And many of those thugs were merely thugs. They could beat you up at worst before the war. But I remember the time in Sarajevo when I suddenly realized that these thugs are carrying weapons now. This was before the war, because suddenly there was an influx of weapons. Mm. So before that, I would have been, as a young man and cocky and whatnot, I could risk to get into a shoving match with someone over whatever, some sort of dispute. But after that point, I realized they might have guns. I was out of that conflict. I wasn't going to participate. So no more shoving matches, because they were armed and I was not. And I remain unarmed. And so once you have weapons, thugs turn into criminals and killers. That was the case in Chicago. It still might be the case in certain parts of Chicago in America.
What's the general theory you're driving at about the recurrence of things? What's the direction of violence in the world from one century to another, from the beginning of the 20th century to the end?
I don't believe in human atavism theory, that we are savages and then it needs to be activated. I think what turns people into killers on a vast scale is a kind of misguided historical projects that are well organized. So the Nazis, obviously, were not savages. Genocide is a technology. It's a very complicated operation, and they needed a vast, well-trained force to do that. Similarly, in the Balkans, of course, here a lot of people represented the conflicts in the Balkans as, tribes at each other's throats, which was a lie in so many ways. But it was also misses the point of genocide, or the technology of genocide, that to kill 7,000 people, 7,000 men in Srebrenica, you need a large number of buses to transport them from point A to point B so they can be shot. Someone has to, organize those buses. There was an army hierarchy and so on. So for the worst in us to be brought out, there has to be, a historical project. And in that vein, not quite the genocidal project, obviously, the Bush administration brought out the worst in Americans. They had a misguided, horrible project, which somehow we're still at. We're still doing it in many ways. And this brought out the worst things in America, and I hated that experience. And which is also to say that opposing such projects becomes a necessary ethical position for every citizen, including writers.
There's a famous moment in the Lazarus Project, everybody quotes it, where Brick is in a fight with his wife. She's American, and she's kind of defending the innocence of the kids at Abu Ghraib. And the Brick character, who has a lot in common with you, writes, "I told her I hated the normal people and the land of the fucking free and the home of the asshole brave. And I hated God and George and all and everything. I told her that to be American, you have to know nothing and understand even less. And that I didn't want to be American." What's happened to that in you? What's happened to that in us?
Well, I have had my anger never quite reached that point. And, you know, Brick is very, very angry with the whole notion of America. So I could write him. And I could write him because during the Bush years, I had a hard time being American. I was more of an American in 99 when I wasn't even a citizen than I was during the Bush years, because it seemed to me that if you were American, you had to sign up for these projects. And I did not want to sign up for those projects in no way. And I did not care how seemingly good the intentions were. Crimes are crimes, regardless of intentions. And that produced a lot of anger in me. I never reached that point as Brick does, but Brick has all kinds of different problems. Most of his problems are different from mine. But that anger is very, very familiar to me. Mm. He acts out my submerged anger.
It wasn't exactly the first time in America. The Brick character writes about this murder, the murder of Lazarus in 1908, that the war on anarchism at that time was much like the current war on terror. He's writing during the Bush administration. Do we know what these cycles are?
Well, they're not so much cycles. They're the method that works, that to unite a nation, you need an enemy. It is very convenient if the enemy is a foreign enemy, and also if they are hard to spot. And so you have to watch them at all times. So then we can be permanently united. So the war can never be won. Because if it's won, there's no reason to be united anymore because the enemy's out. So we have to keep the enemy, you know, the barbarians outside of our wall so as to stay united. And this happens not just in America. This happened in the Balkans. This happens, you know, happened in Rwanda in many ways. You create an enemy so you can unite the nation. Or you magnify the enemy into a monster of some sort. And that's not cyclical. It's simply, if it was a political or, as it were, a historical method. Lazarus found himself in the middle of that all. I was, interestingly, when Lazarus came out in the United Kingdom, in Britain, one of the reviewers pointed at the fact that at the same time there was, when Lazarus was published, there was an inquiry about the shooting of the Brazilian immigrant, you know, who was shot down by the police for pretty much the same reason as Lazarus. He looked dark. He looked terrorist. So they shot him, you know, oopsie-daisy. Mm-hmm. And that's how it works, because they shoot and then they ask questions.
In your book, The Lazarus Project, Chicago in 1908 is the site of a kind of nativist hysteria. 100 years later, precisely, it became the sort of seat of the new, almost transnational American politics. What's happened to us? What's happened to Chicago?
Well, Chicago, much like America, was never just one thing. It's not a monolithic thing. There's no absolute and permanent unification. History operates, with many currents floating through the world and the people, and sometimes those are dominant. And sometimes they become minor. You know, it's always, as long as there has been a history of racism in this country, there has been a history of opposition to racism. You know what I mean? As long as there was an injustice, there were people who were fighting that injustice. The question is, who has a higher hand at what time? And what I like about America is this vitality. It can never be reduced to one thing. You know, and then, of course, many people try to reduce it, and the Bush regime tried to reduce it to one thing, so we can stand united unquestionably. But you can never do it. It's too big, it's too complicated, it's too democratic, and it can never be reduced to one thing. And what happened in Chicago and the United States in the past year is this, that people like myself who were, you know, playing defense, as it were, moved over to the... they start attacking the opponent's goal to score, and we scored, and so it's a good feeling.
Mm-hmm. Does it feel like a different place? I mean, this country, that city? What do you tell your Bosnian readers in Chicago and in Sarajevo?
Well, Chicago was staunchly anti-Bush throughout the 8 years. And I mean, I closely follow this. When the elections, I have election results by precinct and, you know, numbers, how many people. And steadily around 80% or above of people in Chicago voted against Bush, whoever the candidate was. And Obama, of course, he's our boy. That was, Bush did not even fly over Illinois, let alone Chicago. So, which, apart from other things that, you know, made it sort of liberated territory, it also showed, it was an example of what I just talked about, that there are simultaneous forces, or forces operating simultaneously in America, in politics, in everything. And what has changed is that the sense that, you know, we are not defending our the walls of our city anymore. That's what it is. You can open the door, get out, people can come in. I don't feel besieged anymore in Chicago. Because our boys in the White House.
Alexander Hemon, I have to ask you the Nabokov question. There was some piece of that Nabokov question. People love to compare you, the exile, the master of language, the coiner of phrases, the rebuilder of our own language. You invent so many new words, wobbleability. You write about a tremulous light wake. I'm not still sure quite what that is. It had to do with observing the moon.
It's the light of the moon trembling on the water. The reflection of the light of the moon trembling in the water.
You speak of anger, but you also speak of a man speaking angerlessly. It must be flattering. It must be a burden always to be held up to that Nabokov standard.
Well,
how do you feel it?
Well, it's an honor, obviously, to be in the same sentence with Nabokov. I don't feel it as a burden, but there's a bit of it is kind of an insult to Nabokov. I've only written 4 books now. Nabokov has written 40 books in 2 languages. And if he had only written the books in Russian, he would have still been a great master, one of the great writers of the 20th century. So he's a great writer in 2 languages. And so I would be, technically speaking, comparable to Nabokov only after I have written 40 books, and I don't know if that will ever happen. I started a little late, yeah.
But there is something going on there in your language, your invention, your humor, your wit.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to talk about that in a sense, because I would have to praise myself, and I can't do that. Or I would have to expose my faults and, you know, problems. There is I recognize kinship with Nabokov not because, you know, we're the same kin or the same family, but rather this love of language. And there are many other writers, there are many, many writers who love language, and which is why they become writers. You know, the Shakespeare was obviously obsessed with language in ways that I enjoy and read. What I recognize in Nabokov, it's also present in Chekhov and many Eastern European writers, and then many other writers. And that is what it is best expressed by what Nabokov said about Chekhov. And he said that Chekhov wrote sad stories for humorous people, sad books for humorous people, that you couldn't see the sadness unless you had a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And Nabokov is much the same, except he has an additional layer of very polished and perfect and beautiful language. That when it's just language in Nabokov, when it's just the surface, it doesn't quite work. It's fascinating, but, you know, you don't quote that. But Nabokov, in Lolita, there's the funny stuff and the sadness of the situation, of Lolita's situation. In his Russian immigrant Berlin stories, which were written in Russian and translated in English, there's the same thing. They're funny because those people are so sad. And it also works the other way, that you can't see the humor unless you have experienced sadness. And that's something that I recognize in Nabokov and Chekhov and many other writers from Eastern Europe and other places.
I thought of those Berlin stories as I read The Lazarus Project. It's the exile thing as much as anything else.
Well, it's not. I wouldn't call it exile. It's displacement, because Brick is not technically exiled. He could go back to Bosnia. He does. Whereas Nabokov never went back, and none of his people from the Russian stories, they never went back to the Soviet Union. And, you know, there's a novel called Glory, and it's all about a young man who wants to go back to the Soviet Union. It should be a glorious act, but the moment he enters the Soviet Union, the novel ends. So he never wrote about the Soviet Union as such. There's these, you know, anti-utopias that vaguely resemble the oppressive Soviet regime, but he never talked about it. And so it's a crucial difference in many ways. Brick can go back. I go back 2 or 3 times a year. So it's not exile, but there is the displacement, the sense that the streets that you walk on, they have and will always belong to someone else. That's what how Brick feels, that many things that are taken for granted by the natives, as it were, or are in fact what is missing in his life. And so that, if there's similarity, that would be the similarity, that people, displaced people, they look for a place to settle, and it's not just a job and a house in the suburbs. There's a little more than that, because what is lost seems to them so beautiful that the new thing has to be at least, and of course it's a nostalgic distortion, but the new thing has to be at least as beautiful as the previous things. And just to have a good job and, you know, comfortable life, which is would have been a good thing 20 years ago, a great thing, now it's not good enough because somehow the beauty and the joy of something is absent. And Nabokov has the great story, Cloud Castle Lake, in which one of his people goes on a field trip with a bunch of Nazis, and then he spots the perfect spot, where the place that would be his home. And a spiritual home, but of course the Nazis, they would not let him do that. They beat him and beat him. And so it is that, the pursuit of another home. The home thing is inaccessible, or the space for home. And that's related to displacement, not exile, necessarily.
I was listening to you speak about a certain instability of the identity of American writers. It's always being defined. On your own path from Sarajevo to Chicago, where are we now in your own, I don't want to say Americanization, but your own incorporation into this scene?
I am American. I mean, and I feel that way, and not in some sort of transcendental sense, but rather I want to participate in this country, and I've done that in various ways. You know, in the democratic process, in the culture and the language, and my friends and family, my wife and daughter are American. But the difference is I'm not only American because I'm also Bosnian simultaneously. And those are not mutually exclusive. For whatever reason, for the longest time, that was mutually exclusive, or at least it was logistically impossible to maintain those things, because the Ellis Island immigrants, they would move over here, work here, they would speak the language, the next generation would speak English, and it would slowly fade because they could not go back. Mm. You know, letters traveled for a month. They would go back after 50 years to see the old village, and nobody was there. I met a guy in St. Louis, who's the biggest Bosnian community in North America, who likes to watch snow falling in Sarajevo on the web from St. Louis, live.
Wow.
You know, and so there's just not even maintaining personal connection with people. We can have Skype, which I've done. You can Skype with people, but you can, I mean, it's not the same, exactly the same thing, but you maintain the connection. You can watch the snow in Sarajevo. And that's an entirely different situation. So, you know, you can kiss the melting pot goodbye. But the beauty of it is that all kinds of things open up, you know. All kinds of possibilities, languages flowing into each other, experiences flowing into each other. The world becomes more open and a little more unstable, as we all know.
You make it so much more interesting. It's a great pleasure to read you, Alexander Hamon. It's a great pleasure to talk with you, too.
Thank you for talking to me.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Alexander Hamon. Respond, if you will, on Sad Books for Humorous People, on this open, unstable world we live in, on standing in St. Louis and watching snow falling in Sarajevo on the web. Feedback, as you will, on our site at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for joining us.